from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Poet E.E. Cummings turned words into dancers. The way he spaced them on a page, punctuated, unpunctuated, uppercase, lowercase, even spoken, his words bounce and dart, surprising young and old, then and now. Writer Susan Cheever met E.E. Cummings when she was an unhappy teenager, and he was in his last years. He opened up her world in just one evening with just a few words, and she thinks his rebel fun could and maybe should rock our world, our hearts and minds again today. This hour on Point, Susan Cheever on E.E. Cummings. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Has E.E. Cummings charmed, provoked, reoriented you? With what? What line? Do you know his dark side, his body side? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Susan Cheever, author, professor of fine arts at New York's New School and at Bennington College, noted for biographies of figures as varied as Louisa May Alcott and Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, and a memoir of life with her father, the writer John Cheever. Her new book is called E.E. Cummings, A Life, and you can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Susan Cheever, it's great to have you back to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
My immediate sort of sense memory of E.E. Cummings goes all the way back to elementary school, as I recall, and those lowercase poems that somehow just reached out to me, and not me alone, but to children. There is a mischievous quality, maybe just starting with the lowercase, but quickly right on from there, that captures kids. What's that about, Susan?
Well, I think that's something that Cummings did very purposefully. He was, in some ways, very much a child, even as he became an adult, but he did have 2 degrees from Harvard, and he was fluent in Latin and Greek. In other words, they're not childish in the sense that they're uninformed. They're childlike, those poems. But Cummings continued to have a love of children and children's humility and children's humor and children's playfulness, no matter how old he got.
But it's not all sweet impishness. You quote Edna St. Vincent Millay right in the front of the book saying, what I propose then is this, that you, he's applying for a fellowship here, Guggenheim, I guess. She writes, what I propose then is this, that you give Mr. Cummings enough rope. He may hang himself or he may lasso a unicorn. That somehow sounds so early 20th century, but even so, hang himself or lasso a unicorn. What she's talking about him and demons, him and joys, marvels. What's the range?
I think she's talking about, I mean, she's talking to the Guggenheim Foundation, so she's not talking to another poet, but I think she's saying to them, give him enough rope and it might not work. He might hang himself or he might do something you can't even imagine.
What is hanging
the unicorn being what you can't even imagine?
What does hang himself
mean, as
you look at him? I mean, he
might destroy himself. I don't think she was talking about his personal demons, although he certainly had personal demons, as most poets do. I think she was talking about the possibility of failure as a poet.
Think with us then, I don't know, let's blow it up to a bigger scale. You write about his whole life. I mean, he has went to the USSR, fell deeply out of love with communism, became a McCarthyite anti-communist, was criticized for anti-Semitism at certain points in his life. On the other hand, you describe him as this sort of revolutionary modernist breaking open whole ways of sensing and understanding life. Give us a sense of the range of, I don't know, angels and demons, rope and unicorns with E. Cummings.
Well, I think that each piece of his life, and this is probably true of all of our lives, makes sense when you look at it. When you sweep across it like that, it sounds a little odd. Certainly one of the things that happened to him is he went to the USSR right at the beginning of the Stalin purges. And although many people that he knew in his progressive neighborhood of Greenwich Village in Manhattan thought that communism was a wonderful thing, Cummings picked up right away that there was something wrong with the people's connection to the state, that the people were afraid of the state. And he hated that. And so he was really just ahead of his time when it came to understanding Stalin. I think, and his anti-Semitism, you know, one of the struggles that all biographers have is trying to provide context for the lives that they're writing about, so that the fact that many, many people of tremendous intelligence and education were anti-Semitic when Cummings was anti-Semitic does not make it all right. At the same time, that's what it was. He certainly was not, in fact, anti-Semitic. He really didn't care. He didn't care if you were the president's wife or a homeless guy on the street. What he cared about was, would you respond to his playfulness? Would you respond to his idea that the world was a place of delight as well as madness? Would you play with him, so to speak? I mean that in the highest way, or were you bound by rules like the Cambridge ladies who he left? Were you truly anti-Semitic like the Harvard that he turned his back on after having been raised there? Did you hate and judge other people? And those were the things that he fought against his entire life. Even something like the lowercase I, which he developed over many, many years. You know, when we think about E.E. Cummings, we think about a lowercase E.E. Cummings, but he actually started off having a more normal name, Edward Estlin Cummings, with uppercase letters. And then slowly he kind of shrank his own role in the work, literally and figuratively. And the lowercase I came to represent for him a humility, a playfulness, a childlikeness that he valued tremendously. He was against all pretension, against all pompousness, against all bureaucracy. These were the things he really devoted his life to questioning and undermining. And of course, when I ran into him, it was just the perfect accident of timing. I was a very unhappy student in a school where they had very recently rescinded the rule against smiling in the halls.
Oh, Lord.
So that was the kind of thing where he just stepped in and said, you don't belong in this school, which was exactly what I had been feeling. And I owe him a great favor because his ranting against the school, his very funny ranting against the school, allowed me finally to get my father's attention, and I was able to go to a very different kind of school in my senior year in high school, which made all the difference.
This is E.E. Cummings, late in his life. You as just, I don't know, young, 14, 15 years old, your father, John Cheever, but he'd been reading at the school. Interesting that even at that point in his career, he was doing high school readings to make a living. But you're out for, I think it was burgers afterwards, and he's mocking all the teachers of your proper prep school.
Yes, it was a great scene. And to go backwards a little bit, he never was able to make a living very easily. He didn't care about money, but, you know, as a poet, he didn't bring in a lot of money. And at the end of his life, very happily, he became a reader and a lecturer. And that was the first time he ever was able to make a stable living, so to speak, although his expenses were pretty low. He lived in a couple of rented rooms in Greenwich Village. But still, it was a struggle for him to make a living his entire life. In fact, one of his big volumes of poetry was rejected by 15 publishers. And in the end, he borrowed money from his mother, published the book, titled it No Thanks, and dedicated it to the 15 publishers who had turned it down. So those publishers, of course, are now enshrined in memory. But
Your father, John Cheever, loved him for his elegance, even in his near poverty. Your dad envied his ability to pull it off with such elan.
Well, he did, because my father also had tremendous trouble making a living. And it worried my father a lot. He would get very anxious about money, whereas Cummings, who also didn't have any money, was just gallant and chivalrous about it and behaved even down to the last dime, as if nothing could be less important than making money.
He made fun of the Cambridge ladies of his youth, the Cambridge ladies who live in furnished souls, are unbeautiful, and have comfortable minds. What's a favorite line of yours, Susan Cheever, from E.E. Cummings?
Well, actually, that sonnet, The Cambridge Ladies, which just another thing to say about Cummings mm-hmm. is that although his poems appear to be very informal, even haphazard, they are extremely formal. He was a formalist. So that this sonnet is actually a perfect Petrarchan sonnet, but it's written in a way that distracts you from the form so that people think Cummings just threw the words down on the page, but the opposite was the case. Actually, my favorite line, or one of my favorite lines in the whole work, is the last four lines of The Cambridge Ladies, where he, shall I read it? Where
yes,
he
please.
Writes, "The Cambridge ladies do not care above Cambridge if sometimes in its box of sky, lavender and cornerless, the moon rattles like a fragment of angry candy."
Oh, that's great. Does he?
That's pretty good.
A fragment of angry candy in the sky. He looked like candy to me as a kid. You show me the angry side as well. I don't know how much I've read since then. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Susan Cheever. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with Susan Cheever about the American poet, master of the lowercase, E.E. Cummings, born Edward Estlin Cummings. She's written a new biography, E.E. Cummings, A Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's a recording of E.E. Cummings, 1953, in New York, reading his poem, "I Thank You, God, for Most This Amazing."
"I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I who have died am alive again today. And this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings and of the gay, great, happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any, lifted from the no of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you. Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are open."
E.E. Cummings, 1953, reading there in New York. Susan Cheever, two things. First, we're not accustomed to poetry readings much anymore. We're not accustomed to that sound. It can sound very antique. I wonder how he was received
really?
Then. Oh, well, I mean, the message is right up to date, but it takes me back to a time of public poetry readings that I don't think most people brush with these days. And I wonder how he was received then, quite rapturously, you report.
Yes. But I see why. To me, it doesn't sound antique. It sounds musical. And I have to say,
no doubt,
readings today are often very disappointing because people don't, even writers, don't read anymore as if it were anything more than just reading what you've written. And, you know, Cummings, like Dickens or mm-hmm. like John Irving, mm-hmm. Was somebody who took readings very seriously, and he really, you can hear him using his voice like an instrument.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's my point, really, that we don't hear that kind of reading as much. I associate it with somehow mid-20th century.
Well, I hope it makes a comeback, because it's so much more thrilling to hear somebody read a poem or even a paragraph using their voice as an instrument, which, after all, it is, as we know from singers, than it is to hear people just droning on, don't you think?
Yes, I do. Go to his project, what he was up to. I mean, sort of big arc here. He was a proud modernist, you remind us, part of this group, James Joyce and Gertrude Stein, Hart Crane, Marion Moore, and Ezra Pound, and Duchamp, and Picasso, and Matisse. How would he have understood what he was trying to do with his poetry?
How would he have understood it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think his idea was to, as I said, to be extremely formal, to understand poetics better than anybody could, and then to squeeze it until it became very powerful, to sort of twist it until it became more and more powerful. So you'll see in the poems what he does with syntax, where he substitutes a noun for a verb or switches over an adjectival form, that it lends them tremendous power. That there's that poem about the mouse, Me Up It Does, where you can see what he's doing. Instead of saying, a poison mouse looks up at me, he says, you know, Me Up It Does, out of the floor, quietly stares a poisoned mouse. And so what he's doing with syntax kind of goes straight to the heart, I think. And that was his project, to take language and to reinvent it. And in that way, he is very much like James Joyce and like the Cubists, who were taking images and trying to reinvent them.
Picasso with his nude descending the stairs, rearranging pieces to make us look again, and E. Cummings doing it both audibly and also as it looked on the page.
Exactly. Exactly. And Pound was doing that, too. There's a wonderful poem of Pound's called The Return, where he starts experimenting. It's a poem about defeat and failure. And he starts experimenting with the look of the words on the page and with upper and lower case capitals. And, of course, that was tremendously influenced. That was a tremendous influence on Cummings, as it was on T.S. Eliot.
We've asked our listeners for their favorite E.E. Cummings. Leah says, In Just, my absolute favorite because of the way he describes spring, mud luscious and puddle wonderful, so childlike and free. Mandy, I thank you, God, for most this amazing day. We just heard him reading it. Husband and I read it at our wedding. Tanya, Anyone lived in a pretty how town? Jason, she being Brand. Alan is calling from Troy, Alabama. Alan, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Susan Cheever.
Yeah, you know, Cummings was really instrumental in my development as a person. I spent 30 years in the Air Force, and one of the things that kept me going was the fact that I could read Cummings, you know, and one of the lines that really causes me to smile even 30 years later is, here lies little Effie's head, whose brains are made of gingerbread.
Yeah.
You know, he was a funny poet.
Yeah, and then when you try to figure it out, it just envelops you, you know. And after I retired, I taught school for about almost 20 years. And I had students who were categorized as being inefficient. But when they would read Cummings, you could just see the smiles on their faces. And he has one poem, and I can't quite remember it, but it had to do with a male and a female being attracted to each other. And it was almost verging on being what a lot of people in this part of the world would consider to be obscene.
It's May I Feel, really, said he. Right.
Pardon?
It's May I Feel, said he.
Yeah.
That poem.
And the kids would just, they would break out, you know, because one of the things that it seems to me that's forgotten is that poetry is really a balm for the soul, you know. It's almost
well said,
like listening to jazz, and it starts off as a colloquy, but it ends up being a dialogue between a writer and a reader, and that's what's always been important for me about E. Cummings. And I'm 70 years old, and I still smile when I when I think of E. with that, you know, hey, throw that grammarian approach out the window, but really, you throw it out and then you bring it back in, but nobody recognizes it.
Break it up, turn it around.
Well
Alan,
said.
Yeah, well said. And I love the image of you for 30 years in the Air Force with E.E. Cummings' compendium at your side, Alan. That's just great.
Well, you know, if you're in a military and it's not wartime, you know, it can be boring and you need to find something, you know, that gives you some kind of sustenance. And then the other part of it is that Cummings is, he's not on the inside as I saw it. Cummings was always on the edge. And during that period of time, 60s, 70s, I was on the edge, you know, but I managed to make a career of the military, which was almost coming, so I can.
Yes.
We'll try and picture that one, Alan. I so appreciate your call. Hey, Susan, take us to his lustier stuff. There's plenty of it, and I wasn't given that in grade school. Maybe I needed Alan as a teacher. May I feel and write on. He has plenty of body, sensual, sexual poetry.
Well, he was fearless with language, and he was a man who was very interested in sex, and, you know, the results are delicious. There's a lovely little book of his erotic poems that Norton has published, because he also did erotic drawings. And I can't really read those poems on the air, is that correct? But they're wonderful. They're humorous. They're adoring. They're respectful. They're everything you could want in an erotic poem.
What was his attitude toward women as it emerged there and elsewhere?
Well, he loved women. He had a terrible time with his first two marriages. Each one was disastrous in its own way. The first one resulted in a child who Cummings really fell in love with and who was then, to use a word that wasn't around in those days, the child was then abducted. Her mother took the child to live, and Cummings didn't see her for 25 years. And that was pretty disastrous, broke Cummings' heart. And then the second marriage was also disastrous. And so what's interesting was that when he was nearing 40, he met a woman, Marion Morehouse, who is a very mysterious sort of woman, but incandescently beautiful. Mm. And they fell in love and were happy together for 30 years. So, you know, these days we think that you take your problems with you, but either Cummings changed after his second marriage or he just found the right woman.
When it came to writing about love and sex, Susan Cheever writes, Cummings did for poetry what Henry Miller was doing for prose. He started out, well, I mean, you quote him saying, a freshman year at Harvard, I am the aristocracy of this earth. Started out, you know, kind of high-born in intellectual terms and more. When did he turn against that? When did he decide, I mean, you know, you write later that it became, he was a man for whom the unacceptable was like a red flag of invitation for a poet as provocative as Cummings. When did he take on that posture toward life?
Well, it happened at Harvard. And it's very interesting and a little bit mysterious, but going into Harvard, he was a Cambridge aristocrat, a very good boy, someone who had never challenged either of his parents, somebody who grew up in a great big house two blocks from Harvard Yard. His parents were introduced by William James. Mm. It doesn't get much more Harvard than that.
No.
And his father was an early professor of sociology at Harvard. And then his father became a Unitarian minister. And, you know, his mother's family came over on the Mayflower. So it was all in place for him. And sometime in his junior year at Harvard, he began to hate all that. He began to hate all those rules and regulations. And, you know, at Harvard, of course, sex was never mentioned, and nobody ever drank too much. And Cummings discovered Boston when he was at Harvard, and he fell in love with the strip clubs, the old Howard, those women, and he drank a great deal and generally kind of went wild as a Harvard junior with a bunch of equally wild friends. And started rebelling against his parents. And, of course, the president of Harvard, just about the time that Cummings graduated, was Abbot Lowell, who was, you know, a terrible guy. He had tribunals to try homosexuals and have them kicked out of Harvard. He made sure that there was an anti-Semitic quota at Harvard through a variety of devious devices. He actually was on the panel that sentenced Sacco and Vanzetti to death. I mean, not a good guy. And so Harvard took this turn right about the time that Cummings was rebelling, and he just couldn't get out of there fast enough. The minute he graduated, he went to Greenwich Village, where things were very different, where everybody was drinking and having sex and writing poems and doing the things he cared about, and he never left. And he didn't go back to Harvard for really 30, 40 years. He went back finally in 1952 to give the Charles Eliot Norton lectures, which it's fascinating because it was, as John Finley kept saying, it was like Odysseus's return to Ithaca when Cummings finally went back to Harvard.
We'll look at those and more. Susan Cheever's book is E.E. Cummings, A Life. She writes, he was an unabashed and very funny rebel, an astonishingly mobile face, a flexible dancer's body, above all, despised fear. And his life was lived, she writes, in defiance of all who ruled by it. Fear. Ellen's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Ellen, you're on the air with Susan Cheever. Thanks for calling.
I have to say that he got me through Northwestern University. I have a degree in theater from Northwestern. And in 1960 or 59, I was introduced to him. And I have since read everything he's written. I have painted his poems, especially my favorite, When God Decided to Invent Everything. He took one breath bigger than a circus tent, and everything began. When man determined to destroy himself, he took the what he picked, the was of shall, and finding only why, smashed it into because. And that picture is hanging, of all things, in the church. They wanted it and wanted me to write about it. And I said, a favorite poem should never languish on a shelf in a book. It should be where passersby can ponder on the wonders of God and the unfortunate overthinking of that is the human condition. That was my take on that poem, and I just wanted to share that with you. Also, my son, who is a poet, I am not, as a child, would put himself in a little cave and invent poems, and I used to read E.E. Cummings to him, and that would inspire him to write poetry.
Ellen, that's just great. Inspiration for a lifetime there, and a painting to boot. Ellen, thank you very much for your call. Susan, I mean, you must have run into many people who, I mean, you heard Alan in Alabama. There's Ellen in Milwaukee. They carry E. Cummings with them lifelong.
Yes. It's a wonderful thing. It's actually, in my mind, how poetry should work. They both have memorized pieces of the poems, which I think is also a wonderful thing.
I love the combination of the deeply profound and the playful, the mischievous and even the angry, the way they'd come together in E.E. Cummings.
Yes. Well, one of the things that fascinated me about Cummings was the way that he was able to spin straw into gold, you know, take his anger and make it just sing. And you know, he wrote quite a few angry poems, particularly angry poems about the role of government, but also, as Ellen pointed out, angry poems about, you know, the people being nibbled to death by ducks, as he would say. Mm. But he made beautiful poems out of that anger.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Susan Cheever about the American poet, master of the lowercase, and much more, E.E. Cummings, born Edward Estlin Cummings. Her new biography is E.E. Cummings, A Life. You can read an excerpt at our website. Here's Cummings, a visiting professor at Harvard in 1953, reading one of his famous, most anthologized poems, Anyone Lived in a Pretty How Town. Bittersweet take on the loneliness of living amid crushing conformity. Here's the first two verses.
Anyone lived in a pretty how town, with ups so floating many bells down, Spring, summer, autumn, winter, he sang his didn't, he danced his did. Women and men, both little and small, cared for anyone, not at all. They sold their isn't, they reaped their same. Sun, moon, stars, rain.
E.E. Cummings, 1953. Susan Cheever joins us from New York, and Susan, you're right there. The unacceptable was like a red flag of invitation for a poet as provocative as Cummings. Give us some examples of where he saw red flags and charged at them, even when it may have caused him some difficulty.
Well, I think the first place he saw those red flags was at Harvard. And his famous Harvard class speech was about tolerance and being open in ways that he was finding Harvard wasn't. So one red flag, certainly in New England in the early 20th century, was you couldn't talk about sex. And it was a society where piano legs were hidden under piano dresses, and women's underthings were hung on the line inside pillowcases, as if that would make any difference, do you know? Mm-hmm. And so Cummings saw that as a red flag and wrote poem after poem, which talked about women's parts and men's parts and the things that can be done with them in ways that profoundly shocked early 20th century New England. So that was one red flag. Another red flag was, of course, you were supposed to lead a very abstemious life and never drink. And, you know, he saw all that as a cage, certainly a cage for the poet. And this, I think, was at the heart of his almost desperate desire to get to Greenwich Village and stay there, because in Greenwich Village, things were very different. There weren't any red flags for him in Greenwich Village in the early 20th century. It was a place where you could do more or less what you wanted, and people did. Many marriages were open in Greenwich Village. Cummings' first marriage started when he was sleeping with somebody else's wife, and she then had his only child, and they pretended it was the husband's child. That was all condoned in Greenwich Village, and he needed that kind of freedom to write the poems that he wanted to write.
You write his life was lived in defiance. You say this led him into some political carelessness. Reading from you here, after a miserable stint trying to write screenplays in Hollywood, he wrote some stupidly anti-Semitic poems and sentences. Like what, Susan?
Well, there's a famous poem of Cummings, notorious is perhaps a better way to put it, where he talks about the word kike. And it got him in a lot of trouble, as you can imagine. And he never really understood why it was offensive, because his interpretation of the poem was that he thought the word kike was disgusting, you know, that the way that word had come to mean anti-Semitism and a certain kind of person was very disgusting. In other words, in his mind, the poem was protesting the use of the word kike, but of course it was using that very repulsive word.
And so, you write that you say his anti-Semitism is indefensible, language he used is criminal and repulsive. What are you pointing at?
Well, I just don't think that kind of language, it's not okay with me. But again, as I said before, one of the great struggles with biography is context. Who knows what you and I would be saying about people of other races or religions if we were having this conversation in the 1930s, Tom? I mean,
but he was buddies with Ezra Pound, who was pretty well understood as an anti-Semite at that time.
Absolutely, but can you judge somebody by their friends? He was buddies with Pound because of their poetic bond. They were aiming for the same thing, and also Pound was one of his teachers, as Pound was a teacher to almost everyone, almost every writer from Hemingway Eliot in the 20th century. So it wasn't that they sat around and talked xenophobic talk.
He was a fan of Senator Joe McCarthy. How did that emerge, and why, and how displayed?
Well, I think Cummings hated communism from his experience in Russia. As I said, he really saw Stalin for who Stalin was long before most people did. And he came to hate the Russian state and to understand how afraid the Russian people were of the Russian state. So when Senator McCarthy came along talking about communism being everywhere, Cummings tended to go along with him. He certainly had McCarthy called Cummings before the House Un-American Activities Committee, I can guarantee you that Cummings would have told him where to put it. There was no way that Cummings would ever name names or go along with testimony or cooperate with anyone in government. But in a casual way, he thought perhaps McCarthy was right.
There's this amazing story of when he was in World War I Europe. I guess he, like others, had signed up for an ambulance corps. He was called on to attest to his hatred of Germans, and he refused to do it. He said he loved the French, but he refused to say he hated the Germans and ended up in jail for that.
Exactly. I mean, that's classic Cummings, and that certainly in my lowest hours, I wished they had called him before the House Un-American Activities Committee, because he certainly would have done what Pete Seeger did when Pete said, well, I won't testify, but I'll sing you some songs, or something like that. But he hated bureaucrats. He hated people who he felt were motivated by fear and hidebound by the rules. So when they asked him if he hated Germans, and again, he was not a soldier, but an ambulance driver in World War I, he knew that if he just said, yes, I hate the Germans, they'd let him go. But of course, he couldn't bring himself to say that because he understood that the Germans were also people. And so instead he said, I love the French. And of course, that wasn't the answer they were looking for.
And the Telegraph went back to the family in Cambridge. Edward E. Cummings has been put in a concentration camp. Mac is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Mac, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yo, Tom, Susan. Very interesting discussion. Okay. I have, Susan was talking earlier about the sort of anger, and I don't know that I've so much seen that, but there's definitely some darker stuff that he's got, and it's weird. I was never so much a huge fan, although I did enjoy it, but it's probably the poet who stuck with me the most over the years. And I still remember my teacher when I was in high school, and I'm 47, so that's a long time ago, who liked the poem Buffalo Bill's Defunct, who used to ride water smooth stallions and shoot clay pigeons, 1, 2, 3, 4, just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. And how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? And she would read that to us, and, you know, using the words on the page would, you know, animate it in a way that I'd never seen before. And it still sticks with me all these years later and haven't forgotten it. It's probably been, you know, 30 years since I've read it.
Mark, I'm so glad you raise it and read it. Let me take it to Susan Cheever. Susan, you remind us. He was in New York, January 10th, 1917, reading the New York Sun, and there was the headline announcing the death of Buffalo Bill Cody. And here comes this poem with the famous, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? How do you read this poem, Susan?
Well, I read it very much the same way. I think he, you know, what we don't know or what we have forgotten is that Buffalo Bill was the sort of one of the most famous people in the world. And his Wild West show was a huge big deal. So his death was a very big deal. And Cummings, again, it's so typical. He was a young man. I mean, this was really before he had quote-unquote, become a poet. He was working at Collier's, but it's a challenge. How do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? So here is Cummings, even in his 20s, throwing down the gauntlet to death, but it's a beautiful poem. It's the way it's laid out on the page really tells you how to read it. Just, you know, if you say Buffalo Bill's defunct, it's so much stronger than if he had said Buffalo Bill died yesterday. So it's, I think it's an extraordinary poem, and I think it shows you many of the things that would become Cummings' hallmarks, including, as our caller said, his anger.
This eulogy that he wrote, I guess, a poem, sardonic eulogy of Anne Barton. You described it, how he had a daughter by her. She'd been from a poor family, molested by her father. She died 10 years after he wrote this, what you call the concise portrait. It's really strange. Annie died the other day. Never was there such a lay, whom among her dollies, dad first, don't tell your mother, had making Annie slightly mad, but very wonderful in bed. Saints and satyrs, go your way. Youths and maidens, let us pray. So much empathy and anger all at once, alongside the sardonic quality there, Susan.
Yes, it's a very, it's a little poem that's like a bullet.
Yeah.
Just sums it all up very angrily, anger on her behalf. And
don't tell your mother. She'd been molested by her dad, you know.
Exactly, exactly. But very angry. And often in these poems, in the most powerful of them, it's the anger that animates the poetry. And, you know, anger has a very bad rap these days. You're not supposed to be angry. Mm. It's bad to be an angry person. But actually, I think that anger is often at the heart of creativity. And I think it quite clearly was at the heart of Cummings' creativity.
Jennifer is calling from Niantic, Connecticut. Jennifer, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I called because there's a book that I read, when I was in college, by Cummings called The Enormous Room. And it was, I think, the most beautiful book I ever read, and I never heard anybody else talk about it.
Oh, let's talk about it.
Let's do, let's do, yes.
Bringing it up.
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. Introduce us, Susan.
That, we've sort of gone over this, but when he was incarcerated in a French concentration camp for 3 months, he wrote a book about it at his father's urging. His father was irate and wanted to sue the United States government and the French government. And Cummings said to him, no, 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 instead of suing them, why don't I write a book about it? And, you know, this is, again, classic Cummings. He takes a horrible experience being incarcerated, sleeping on these buggy straw mats, not getting enough to eat, living in a huge room, which of course becomes The Enormous Room. And he turns it into something that is so beautiful and so much about the human condition and so gallant that you almost forget that he was really starving to death. And when they finally got him home, he was really, really sick. So, you know, he makes The Enormous Room sound as if it's the most wonderful place on earth, even as he's telling you, you know, about peeing in a bucket and having coffee that you can see through. But there's a wonderful, he's just wonderful about the characters that he finds himself with. And of course, you know, it's wartime, so all kinds of people ended up in being incarcerated. And thank you for bringing it up, because, of course, it's a memoir, and it's just quite thrilling both to just read it and to think about it in the context of his attitude towards this kind of adversity.
You think about different times, different books, different perspectives. World War II, you get JFK and Profiles in Courage. World War I, you get E.E. Cummings and The Enormous Room. One more quick call, Sarah in Rockport, Massachusetts. Sarah, our time is short, but thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I am calling because in college I became aware of E. Cummings in a fairly big way, and I was married at 22 in 1972 on his birthday, and it was intentional. Interestingly enough, as that marriage was coming to an end in 1975, I was in Mexico on my 25th birthday. And I was in San Cristobal de las Casas in the highlands of Chiapas, which is a glorious place. And as I awoke on my birthday, I heard this very high-pitched sound out the window. And I looked out the window, and there was a balloon man whistling Far and We. And it just tied him, it sealed my relationship with E. Cummings, that very image that he depicted in Just.
That's so great.
So alive.
Yeah. The poem In Just, which ends, of course, it's spring and the goat-footed balloon man whistles Far and We. Conformity. He always tried to blow it up, Susan Cheever.
Exactly. Like a balloon.
Are the 60s some kind of love child of E. Cummings and poetry?
Well, I don't know. I think that things happen. I think the 60s were, having lived through them, an extraordinary time, a terrible, terrible time, but also a time when we all thought people were going to learn to get along. And I think Cummings and Henry David Thoreau were very much part of that.
E. Cummings died in 1962. Susan Cheever brings a life and a great work of body of work of poetry to us in her new book, E. Cummings, A Life. Susan Cheever, it's always great speaking with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Listeners, you can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for all your E. Cummings favorite lines and poems. Find them online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.